Okay. We hereby start the ASEF meeting of April 2018. And the first issue that we are going to discuss are rate-regulated activities. And I'll give the floor to Jane.
Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody. It's been a little while since we talked about rate-regulated activities, and since then the Board have made some tentative decisions, which we've outlined in the papers, Agenda Papers 1A and 1B. The decisions that have been taken by the Board so far have focused, first of all, on the unit of account that we're going to be using within the model that we're developing to reflect rate-regulated activities. And the slides in Papers 1A that deal with the unit of account start at slide number 13 and highlight that the Board have rejected a model that focuses on the regulatory agreement as a whole. We talked about this a few times in the past, so we're not going along an intangible asset model to try and reflect all of the rights and obligations within the regulatory agreement, but instead we're focusing on the timing differences that are generated by the rate adjustment mechanism that is contained within the regulatory agreement. And it's those timing differences that entities track. They originate in one period when the regulated rate doesn't reflect the activities of the period in full. So sometimes you may have the entity fulfilling regulatory requirements during the period, but the rate doesn't yet reflect those activities. But the rate adjustment mechanism means that the rate will be adjusted in the future to incorporate the additional amount of compensation to which the entity is entitled because they've already fulfilled some service requirements. Alternatively, the regulated rate could include some amounts that relates to activities that the entity carries out to fulfil service requirements in a future period, in which case the entity can collect amounts through the regulated rate in an earlier period than the period in which they carry out the related activities. So it's only those timing differences that the model is trying to capture. The rest of the rights and the obligations, the rest of the activities of the entity, we believe are adequately accounted for using existing accounting standards. And so we're calling this model the supplementary model. Once we've identified what it is that we're trying to account for in the model, the unit of account, paper 1A from slides 18 onwards focus on, first of all, the timing difference that creates a right to include an additional amount in the future rate to reflect the activities that we've already carried out to fulfil service requirements, and identifies whether that incremental right represents an asset as defined in the financial statements, and similarly, if the timing difference works the other way round, does that amount that's been included in the rate in advance of the activities that have been performed, does that reflect an obligation as defined in the revised conceptual framework? So the first part of this session, what we would like you to do is answer question one, which is in paper one, just below paragraph 9, which is focusing on the rationale that's included in those slides I've just referred to in paper 1A, which based on the revised conceptual framework, and we've put some extracts from the revised financial statements in those slides, and what we're looking for from you is advice whether that rationale is clear. Are there any gaps? Are there any things that are not clear enough, that are understandable, that we may then need to improve on as we're communicating the rationale going forward? I will ask you to focus on paper 1A first of all, but I will highlight here paper 1B because they are very closely intertwined. Paper 1B highlights the scope of the model, or the intended scope, and it highlights the way that we've been defining what we're calling defined rate regulation as the project has progressed. And we've reached a definition that paper 1 says that the Board were going to discuss But the board did discuss that in their March meeting, and the board made a tentative decision to accept the staff's recommendation to go with the scope as it's defined in paper 1B. So we're looking at a regulatory agreement within a formal framework which has enforceable rights and obligations on both the entity and the rate regulator, and the regulatory agreement includes a basis for setting the rate that has this mechanism that creates the timing differences that we're talking about as the unit of account for the model. So the board has made that tentative decision, which was an update we said we would give at the start of this meeting. So what I would like to do is start and ask you to comment on paper 1A first of all, and then we'll come back and talk about the scope later in the meeting. And with that, I'll open to the floor.
Kimberly nodding a lot. She has something to say.
I'll start if you like. I guess I just wanted to make first of all a couple of comments about the unit of account and then focus more on the asset and liability piece of it. So in terms of the unit of account, firstly just to say it makes sense in terms of the decision that the board reached around the unit of account going with option 3. And I think in particular why that made sense to me is the rationale that you've provided for looking at the asset and liability definition. They did fit together, and I think that's a point that could be made when you're explaining the rationale. I mean, quite rightly, you're focused on what the conceptual framework says about the unit of account, and agree with that. But I just think an additional point when you're explaining the rationale is the connection between the unit of account and the decisions around assets and liabilities. Sort of helps to see that they fit together. And I think the other point it would be useful to make is around practical considerations, because somebody's preliminary thought when they look at that might think, well, gosh, that sounds like a whole lot of work to track these individual amounts. So they might have a negative reaction initially, but it's my understanding, I think it is mentioned in your slides, that actually in reality entities in this sector do have to track those individual amounts anyway for regulatory purposes. So, in fact, it's probably more practical for them than doing something different. So I think it's quite helpful to add that to it. So turning then to the assets and the liabilities, I mean, first of all, I wanted to say I think the rationale that you've outlined now is a lot clearer. I mean, we've all gone through on a journey with this and kind of explored different ideas as we've gone through the project. So I think it's a lot clearer. And then in terms of what else could be you could say, I guess I've come at it from a point of view as one of the people in the past who have raised issues. What else could you say that would help convince, I guess, if you like, the sceptics? Because what I was thinking about, I was reflecting back, I think, on some comments that Patricia made, I think, last time when she was reporting some feedback from Europe earlier around what do people think about this in terms of the definitions of assets and liabilities. And I think her three categories were the, yes, we agree, they are assets and liabilities, no, we don't agree, and the third category was, we don't care, which I think was probably, you could extrapolate that to the world, really, and say that's kind of a good summary with the three camps. So in reflecting on those three camps, those who are convinced, I think what you've got here, it will work for them. Those that don't care probably don't necessarily need to be convinced, but I think to be fair to that category, I think they're focusing more on the concerns that have been raised from users of financial statements around, I guess, the missing pieces, what people see are the missing pieces in the performance statement under our current accounting model. And so they're focusing more on have more complete performance story in the statement of financial performance by recognising these regulatory balances. And therefore, they're perhaps less concerned about whether that necessarily meets the asset and liability definition. And sometimes in standard setting, we do we do have to make choices, and I think that's an important point to make for everybody, really. Just as an aside, you know, we've been working around some very complex conceptual issues around accounting for social benefits in the public sector space, which is terribly challenging to think about, well, when does a liability arise? And you end up coming back to say, we can have all these debates, but what actually makes sense? What's going to provide useful information? So I think that's an important message to get across. But for the, I guess, the third category, the people that are not necessarily convinced, I think I had a number of suggestions, and bear with me because I've hopefully got some helpful thoughts. You can tell me at the end whether they were helpful or not. But in terms of the definitions, I'm going to talk about the liability side because I think the asset side's easier, particularly under the new conceptual framework where it emphasises assets as bundles of rights. So the idea that, you know, maybe you've got this regulatory agreement but you can break it down into smaller pieces, I think that's helpful on the asset side. I've still got, I guess, some residual concerns around interdependencies between the pieces that you're recognising and the pieces that you aren't recognising. You know, if, you know, asset, the one you're recognising is an asset, but the unrecognised pieces have perhaps suffered an impairment, which you're not seeing. But then that's something to think about, I guess, for note disclosure. In terms of looking at the liability side, and particularly focusing on slide 22 in the pack, which I think summarises the rationale that you've got there. When I first read that through, it seemed to me that there was like two different ways of thinking about how you get to the liability answer. And I started out thinking, well, should you kind of pick one? But I'm not sure if you necessarily need to, and it might be that including both rationales and the basis for conclusions would be helpful, because then people, depending on what resonates with particular people. So when I started this, I looked at the pink box in the middle. The entities include an amount in the current rate for a service requirement is not yet fulfilled, which sounds, I think, very similar to an IFRS 15 performance obligation situation where you've perhaps received some money from your customers in advance and you haven't yet performed. I think I know you're using service requirements much more broadly than an IFRS 15 sense, but that incomplete performance story, I guess, is what I take from that. And that's when you look at some of the other stuff, like in the appendix, it's very much consistent with this sort of incomplete performance. And the examples you've got underneath it, so receiving amounts from customers in advance, you've got this penalty that's been imposed but you haven't yet settled, you've got an overcharge effectively, which you have to, I guess, in another, you very loosely refund, if you like, using that very loosely. And if we're outside a rate-regulated environment, I think it would be quite simple to get to the view that there's a liability for that incomplete performance. So, for example, if you had incurred a penalty, you would just accrue the liability to pay the penalty and you'd be kind of done. But obviously in a rate-regulated environment, it's done differently. It's instead reduced, that what you charge in the future is reduced. Now, some might see that's just like form over substance. That's just a mechanism for paying the penalty. It's just a mechanism for giving a refund to customers. And in substance, the liability exists today for that incomplete performance. So I think that's one way of thinking about it. There's a liability for incomplete performance. Now, some people might still challenge that and say, well, have you really got a liability if you're not actually paying a penalty? All you're doing is charging less in the future, which I think is where above that sort of orange box that says a regulatory obligation to provide goods or services at a rate reduced by an incremental amount as a result of past events. Now, that kind of rationale to me sounds similar to what we talked about in the past, which is it's analogous to an executive contract on unfavourable terms. Now, I noticed in paper one you said we're not accounting for executive contracts. And I thought, well, if you mean by that we're not accounting for executive contracts with customers, then yes, that makes sense. We're not doing that. We are focusing on the obligations under the regulatory agreement. But I think the idea still seems to be there. When I read that, it still seems to be similar to the idea that you're required, as a consequence of these past events, you're required to undertake an exchange in the future on unfavourable terms. You're charging less than what you otherwise would have charged. And I think in the past we've sort of raised three challenges to that, and I think it would be useful to cover those challenges off. But one is around it's not necessarily an onerous contract, so you still might be profit-making. And thinking some more about that, I think we already have examples today where, depending on which standard you're in, you may or may not have a liability, and it comes down to measurement. So if you take, for example, an obligation to sell gold for, say, 100, and the gold is actually now worth 120, I think if we're in IFRS 9 territory, we can see there's a liability there for the 20 because we're giving something that's worth 120 and we're only allowed to charge 100. But if you took that same contract and put it in IAS 37, say I'm a gold miner, for example, and my cost is less than 100, I still might be making a profit. So it may not be an onerous contract under IAS 37, but that's really a measurement issue. And the other example I was thinking of, it's a little bit out of date, but operating leases. If you have an operating lease where you're paying above market rate, in a business combination, you have to recognise the unfavourable element. But that same contract under IAS 37 may not be onerous because it's a cost model. And the reason I'm saying that is I think if you give sort of examples of where we do something similar today in another context, that kind of helps, where you're focusing on the value that's being delivered rather than the cost. I think that helps at that point. I think the other challenge has been why are we recognising these pieces for these non-financial items when we don't ordinarily? So in other situations where we might have an unfavourable arrangement. And I think the answer to that goes back to the reason for doing the project in the first place. So I think, although I'm sure you explain the reason for doing it as part of the basis for conclusions at the beginning, I think when you get to this discussion of assets and liabilities, linking back to that will answer that question. So just like in business combinations, it's a very specific set of circumstances in which we do something that's a little bit different to regular accounting. This is another very specific set of circumstances, and there's a reason for that. And I think the third challenge that certainly something that I raised in the past was the examples I've just given around like a commodity contract or operating lease. We're talking about fair value, comparing the normal market rate to what we might have to do. And fair value doesn't quite work in a rate-regulated environment. The whole willing buyer, willing seller idea doesn't work. But I guess I think there's an argument you could say that the rate setting mechanism is a surrogate for that because it's designed to ensure that the rate is both fair to customers and also fair to the entity. So it's kind of a surrogate. So then it is similar to those other situations where we're looking at fair value, and you've therefore, if you think of it that way, then you can argue, well, our rate that we have to charge in the future is unfavourable compared to the normal rate, and that normal rate is a surrogate for the value of the goods or services that we deliver. So I think, sorry that was very long-winded, but I was sort of challenging myself to convince myself of the argument, so I thought, well, I'm sure there'll be other sceptics, and I know there are other sceptics out there, so covering off those arguments, I think, will tell a more convincing story.
It's good to see that your scepticism is becoming more residual.
Thank you. That's very helpful, Kimberly. Thank you.
Sven?
Yeah, I think I will be also in the camp of this individual timing difference approach. However, I think you need to check, or we need to be clear, are we all on the same page what we exactly mean with individual? So what exactly is this, let's say, separation criteria, and how do we do this sort of breakdown into individual REM components? Because when I went through the material in the slides, my first reaction was, what's exactly the difference between this net and individual approach? So as long as we treat, let's say, positive and negative REMs symmetrically, I thought, okay, if I'm just adding up the individual elements, isn't that exactly the same as the net approach? So that was something in my head. And another reaction was, individual obviously can't mean by individual customers, because that was one of the issues in the whole concept, that we have what you call probably a customer base, so we don't have this individual contract and don't know who exactly is the counterpart. So probably that needs to be quite clear, that the idea here is more, my impression is your idea is what is the regulatory background, the jurisdiction, what is the legal background for a certain REM to appear, and that is what I think is individual. And if that's the idea, I think that's the thing what it should be, because otherwise you might mix up things which do not necessarily belong together. And we've just heard probably elements of onerous contracts and things like that, so there might be some reasons why the symmetrical treatment wouldn't work. And just to be sure, I would also favor this individual approach. And I think, indeed, most companies already have exactly this data available, so it shouldn't be a big deal.
Thank you.
Patricia?
Well, you'll be pleased to know that we generally support everything that's been said in paper one. A couple of points. Some are still concerns. You don't explain why things weren't assets and liabilities under the old framework, but I'm sure you're capable of dealing with that. And I think you need to do a little bit of clever footwork on slide 25, because in the case of receiving amounts from customers in advance, you're in fact dealing with an incremental rate today and a reversion to normal. You're not dealing with a normal rate today and a decrement. So I'm sure you can argue your way around it, but it isn't quite as it's portrayed on slide 25. And just a bit further explanation, I think, will get you out of trouble.
Okay, thank you.
Noble.
I'll represent the OSSG for this session. One member who specifically responded to this question thought that they agreed with the tentative decision.
Can you speak up a little bit now?
Yeah. but this member was not fully convinced with the rationale for why regulatory liabilities met the definition of a liability, and they wanted more discussions on that point.
You?
I was just going to ask, were there any specific points that meant they weren't convinced?
They said that they were not fully convinced whether the obligation to provide goods or services at a rate reduced by an incremental amount meant what was really an obligation to transfer an economic resource.
First of all, we do appreciate the efforts that the ISB made to move this project forward. However, we can see the progress in this project. And before this meeting, we sought some comments from the stakeholders in China, and some accounting firms and the regulators expressed their concerns. So I would like to share with you some of the concerns. The first one is about the nature of the regulatory right and obligation. According to the paper, the incremental rights and obligation are arising from the timing differences. But in the Chinese stakeholders' view, that they think it may be argued that they come from the difference between an entity's forecasted results and its actual result. So it's this kind of differences that cause the cost will not be covered or overcovered and trigger the adjustment of rates. Based on the new model, the financial statement reflects the estimated performance of an entity instead of the actual performance of an entity. So they think this might lead to the earning management in practice. That's the first concern. The second one is about the relationship with the revenue standards. Something that the rates are paid only by the customers, and the regulatory adjustment is one of the parts of the revenue, no matter which period it is received. So many people find it's a little bit hard to understand this rationale, and they hope the staff could further clarify the relationship between this project and the existing standards, especially IFRS 15, in the discussion paper. So how to coordinate with the revenue standards. That's the second point. The third one is about measurement. Even if the regulatory right and obligation meet the definition of assets or liability in the new conceptual framework, but there is still uncertainty about the recoverability of these deferred accounts. And under some circumstances, the consumption volume might fluctuate greatly in the long period. So how to make sure the measurement of the liability or asset is reliable is a big challenge. That's the third point. The fourth one is about the scope of the project. According to the paper, the rate-regulated entity usually enjoy a monopoly or similar position under the regulatory framework. Some people may argue that it's maybe unfair for those self-regulated entities, because for some self-regulated entities, they also have similar monopoly position like the regulated entities. So that will lead to different accounting treatment for the rate-regulated entities and the self-rated entities that may affect the comparability of financial statements. That's the fourth point. The last one is some suggestion. In order to have a better understanding of the rationale of this model, some people suggest to staff to provide some real cases, some cases or examples based on the real cases. For example, maybe can provide a longer period, not just 2 years, so people can see how to make the accounting treatment and what is what does the regulation say? What is the process frequency of the rate adjustment? So maybe it will be helpful for people to have a better understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Linda.
Thank you. So I'm in the enviable position of not having to say anything, but I agree with a lot of what's been said at the table. But I do want to take first the time to say that I thought that the materials were very well done. And I commend both the staff and the board for giving transparency to, you know, some historical issues that we have had to get on the table that are so important to this project, including the discussion you had with regard to assets and liabilities. And including even in the materials, the way you tracked the concerns that were that came out of World Standard Setters, and you're showing how you're dealing with those, I found a certain comfort that you're actually, you know, being so transparent in those activities because of the nature of this particular project. So we commend you for that. We are certainly supportive of your tentative decisions around the unit of account and the origination of regulatory assets and liabilities. The one thing that we would encourage you to be very clear on, and yes, you're looking at individual timing differences, but the notion of identifiable timing differences also is important, because otherwise you may have people misconstruing the notion of estimation difference between what you estimate in actual versus the actual identifiable timing difference. We think that concept is very important. We also think it's very important that you focus on the notion of enforceability, that those are actually enforceable by the compact that you have with the rate regulator. And in particular, one of the things we observe in our marketplace, again, just in the last 2 weeks, there was another major announcement of an acquisition, that acquisitions are occurring on a regular basis. So Canadian entities are acquiring other entities who have rate-regulated activities, and they are paying the premium for these deferral accounts. And so the notion of enforceability and ultimate collectability is crucial in that regard. So that's kind of a tangential issue, but it is important in terms of the notion of these items. So I just encourage you to make that very clear. And in particular in our marketplace, well, I can't say yet that the vast majority of acquisitions are U.S.-based. It certainly is starting to appear that the Canadian companies are acquiring more and more U.S. operations. And so then the last bit is at some point either we or you or in conjunction with discussions are going to have to look at where this particular project lands vis-a-vis the current standard in the U.S. and compare and contrast, because for our stakeholders, that's going to be an important element of communication, which you haven't asked about yet, and we haven't got to communication, but I just want to mention that vis-a-vis the comment on acquisitions. I have more comments on scope, but I'll wait until we're ready for that.
Thank you.
In that respect, I was planning to ask Russ that when he sees the more concrete choices that we have made thus far, how far apart are the two models?
Sorry, Russ.
I think we're much closer now than perhaps you were a few years ago. I do agree. I do believe that the regulatory order or the inclusion of the regulatory nature, I do believe it creates an asset and a liability. And with respect to actually how this would apply to real-world examples, I'd be happy to put you in contact or to work with you to meet with some of the American utilities that deal with this on a daily basis and go through some of their scenarios to understand how far apart the actual results will be. I suspect at the macro level it's very close, but I do believe that there could be some minor differences, and the only way to find that out is going to be actually with real accountants who actually apply this on a daily basis.
Tommaso?
Yes, thank you. Just a very quick comment on the unit of account. Like Sven said before, I also struggled a bit at the beginning on distinguishing on this individual whether versus net regulatory unit of account. But at the end, I think that the position of the staff in considering individual unit of account is more close through the way that, you know, different components of the tariff release during the period, the subsequent periods. In terms of whether a regulatory right gives rise to an asset, I want to touch the point that Linda raised before. I mean, again, here we talk about rights, and, you know, often these rights could be conditional to some future events, which may or may not just be formal approval or something different. So, again, the concept of enforceability and how it works in these cases, I think, is very important. For this reason, I think it's very, very important to make outreaches with utilities to see whether and how it works.
No further issues.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, I think now we can move on to paper 1B, which looks at the scope. And as I mentioned earlier, the board met in March and looked at the definition that we've got on slide 7 and tentatively decided to pretty much go with the words that are in there with some minor editorial concerns. But basically, we're looking at a formal regulatory framework that's binding on both the entity and the regulator, which emphasises the enforceability point that several people have already raised, and that establishes this mechanism for setting the rate, and that mechanism includes this rate adjustment mechanism where entities can track through the activities that they need to carry out to fulfil their service requirements and how that impacts on the rate, both currently and in the future, to identify the timing differences that we're talking about. Earlier in paper 1B, we have some of the earlier definitions that we've been using in the discussion paper in the previous exposure draft for rate-regulated activities.
that those definitions have been refined, and what we've tried to end up with on slide 7 are just those features of defined rate regulation that are both necessary and sufficient to form the scope of a standard. So we've tried to take out areas of subjectivity, judgment that are not absolutely necessary in order to identify that these rights and obligations through the rate setting mechanism and the rate adjustment mechanism in particular are rights and obligations. Again, in paper one, the question that we would like to ask is slightly different, just to say whether you think that the description there of the definition of defined rate regulation, which will establish the scope, is sufficiently clear that entities will be able to identify whether they have activities within the scope of the definition. And notice here as well, we're looking at activities within the scope. We're not looking at the whole of the entity's business being in the scope. It's just those parts of the business that are connected to this timing difference mechanism. So again, with that, I'll open to the floor for comments on the scope.
Sven?
So I think in a nutshell, basically, you said it's bindingness, so some sort of enforceability plus the existence of this REM. I think you've also explained, it's also in the slide, why you, I think, got rid of this idea of essential services, because this subjectivity idea. On the other side, I think we need to be a little bit careful that there are no, let's say, unintended consequences on the scope, or the scope gets much, much too broadened. Because in my mind, there's still this canteen example. So companies running a canteen for a company also has some sort of contract saying, okay, you can adjust the cost next, or you can adjust the prices next period if the cost this period to produce the food and the lunch has have increased. And probably this would also be in the scope as you define it so far, if we are moving away from this pure essential services. I mean, I know, and I also agree that usually standards shouldn't be any sort of industry specific, so they should introduce a general concept which works for everyone or doesn't work if the concept is not in place. However, this is the only fear, the only risk I see. Is there, where's the borderline or where's the limit saying this is not this type of service or this type of things are, is not in the structure? Because if you don't have this sort of essential services, what is missing is this sort of, is it 100% sure that you will get this money in the future? I think that was one of the questions we raised somewhere at the beginning. How can we, or is there any criterion saying it's very sure that you will get this in the future, and this is the reason why you can do this sort of accrual? And I think in the definition now, this is no longer there. So you could argue, well, it's binding, it's enforceable, but if you have no customer in the future, you will not get this rate. And I think it should be somewhere in there saying it needs to be sure that you'll get it, and not only 50 or 60%. It needs to be really sure that you'll get this amount in the future, and only in this case we allow you this sort of accrual.
Linda?
Thanks. So becoming convinced that the articulation of scope is very important, and I'm becoming convinced of that based on dialogue with our stakeholders. So, for instance, in our last User Advisory Council meeting, and you were on the phone for that discussion, so you're aware of what I'm talking about, but anecdotally, we had one very senior analyst, very sophisticated analyst, who asked the question about why the particular drug formulary mechanism in the province of Ontario, whether or not it would be subject to this guidance. So it becomes very important. I mean, if someone else had asked this question, I wouldn't have been surprised. But for him to ask that question, I was intrigued. So I think you have to very carefully articulate. I agree with the notion that it's not an industry. It is the activities themselves. And there's two parts of that. It's the actual activities with the timing difference, but it's the definition and how you articulate the notion of regulator. So I think you have to be very clear. As soon as people hear the word regulator, they go to government. So you have to be very clear that there's a, you know, the rate regulator, it's a rate setting mechanism. It's not the securities regulator. It's not the prudential regulator, et cetera. So you have to be very clear about that. Because even in industries where traditionally their whole business was subject to rate regulation, over a period of time where things become deregulated, it becomes a pocket of activities that stays under this mechanism as opposed to the whole industry. So I think that's really important. The other thing that we've had some discussions on locally that I think we need to clarify, and this kind of overlaps into communication a bit, but it's still within scope, is how the scope of this interacts with IFRIC 12 service concession arrangements. And I observe that because service concession arrangements are not all that typical in Canada, but we started looking at, you know, whether or not some we think are really service concession arrangements. And so some people may not understand the difference between what you're defining here versus the service concession arrangements. So what I would encourage you is to make sure that you have clarity in that, even if it's only in your communication materials.
Tricia?
In our discussions with our national standard setters, people are generally comfortable with the approach, but like Linda, it's going to hinge critically on what I'd call the sub-definitions. So I think rate regulator, yes, but you're also going to need to think of a definition of regulatory framework and rate adjusting mechanism, because those three are going to be fairly critical keeping this constrained. We're also hearing the concerns that Sven brought up about the potential for this to be applied by analogy to all sorts of situations. And it may be a case where you actually might have to prohibit application by analogy, which isn't something I like suggesting, but it is a very real concern that it'll creep into a lot of places where you've got everything except the regulation isn't under the government or some form of statute. And that is the real concern, is not so much for these activities, but for the other similar activities.
Thank you.
Kimberly.
Yeah, I certainly like to echo those comments that Patricia made about, you know, it's obviously going to be extremely important to be very clear about what's in and what's out and not permitting by analogy. The other point is, I noticed on the slide where you're very clear around saying, you know, it has to be binding, enforceable, doesn't include self-regulation, which makes sense. But also, I think the existing definition of rate regulator, which I don't think you've actually discussed yet, I think it's on the to-do list, allows for the regulator to be a related party to the entity, including its governing board, and I wasn't quite sure how to tie that with the idea that it can't include self-regulation, and so maybe it's to do with other pieces of the puzzle, but that's sort of, something to think about.
I think with that, but you're right, it's something we will need to build in, is where the regulation really constrains the governing body so much that they can't really apply that much self-regulation. They're basically following the formula that's within the framework, but you're right, we need to make sure that we nail that down.
Yeah, because you wouldn't want to have a situation where any entity can create it's turn itself into a rate regulated activity through a later party. Yeah.
Thank you.
Tommaso.
I would like to comment on the point raised by Sven about whether there is a possibility that within this scope some other contracts could fall in. I understand that there is already an interpretation which deals with relationship in a regulatory framework, which is IFRIC 12. In which it is defined how to account for service concession between public to private, and it's also said that it could be, I think in the basis for conclusion, it could be analogized to private to private contracts. I understand the risk. On the other way, I think that the way it's structured now, the scope is also easily to be understood. I think that to avoid this risk could be also considered to work on the recognition criteria in the standard, you know, what Sven said before, whether there is a stable customer base to which you will deliver a service in the future. This could be a criterion for recognition of this asset.
Russ?
So I think the approach you're taking on slide 7 is a sound approach. I think you've probably gone about as far as you can go without actually getting broad-based input from outsiders and potentially having them bring their contracts in a private nature and the regular agreements and studying it. At this point, you need to get something out there to move the ball. I think your approach here is a sound approach, and I do think you'll be able to get incremental improvements about the wording, but only after you actually have the detailed feedback from the people that will have to implement it. I suspect that those jurisdictions where there is greater securities regulation, greater review of the auditors will probably have more detailed requests for what this line is than other jurisdictions. And that may be where you want to focus your attention.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, we just have one remaining question, which is a more general question about communication materials in paper one after paragraph 9. And that is, given the rationale and the scope that we've been discussing so far this morning, what types of communication materials would you advise that we perhaps try and focus on, particularly given, you know, the modern communication world is a discussion paper on exposure graphs sufficient, or are there other types of communication materials that perhaps we think would be able to allow us to focus more on getting to the stakeholders that we perhaps need to get more detail from?
Noble?
Yes, thank you. One AOSSG member commented that another discussion paper would be helpful. And because that this jurisdiction thought that some of the basic elements of the model was controversial, and that including whether regulatory assets and liabilities meet the definition under the new conceptual framework, and about the proposed measurement of within the model. Another member thought that regardless of whether the due process document is a discussion paper or an exposure draft, this jurisdiction thought that the ISB should solicit views from people outside the ISB as soon as possible to make progress on this project.
Thank you.
Russ?
So I would encourage you to consider I took the question primarily as how other not necessarily exposure draft or discussion paper, but primarily how would you get the word out, whatever you choose to do. I would encourage you to think about the specific industries that you think will be impacted and will meet the definition, as well as other industries that are close that you don't think will actually meet the definition, to help people understand what's in and what's out. I would also encourage you to think about outreach to the regulatory bodies that may have a request to change various regulatory orders so you can understand what their timing may be. In the U.S., when we have this, and we have a lot of regulatory bodies. They go from not only just the federal, but there's the state, county, cities. It takes a while for those contracts to filter down, and so that could be could be a good learning opportunity about the cost and the timing of changes.
Tomas,
it seems to me that we are now discussing a lot of I would say details on how it should work. So I think we are more inclined to root towards an exposure draft rather than a discussion paper. But on the same time, I think it's very important at this stage to try to understand on the main topics whether and what are the implications for the industries. So I would encourage to, you know, try to continue to make some outreaches and to really understand that, you know, the decision taken right now really fits with the way the business is conducted by interest parties. But I think we are more in the route of the exposure draft itself rather than and on timing. It seems to me that is the next step is the next public step should be the next year. So I think there's enough time to, you know, to work to that.
Kimberly.
One suggestion around content is to include some illustrative examples of, you know, worked examples. I think that's going to be very useful. Obviously, if it's an ED, you might be doing that anyway. But if it's a discussion paper, it's usually quite narrative. But so I think some worked examples would be useful.
Mary?
I probably should hold off because I'm going back more to before you sum up on a couple of things first.
Linda?
I just emphasize again the point that I think what you need to do in your communications, we've got a big focus on plain English as opposed to standard speak, so I encourage you to continue with the plain English communication. And in that communication, emphasize the scoping, the activities, it's not the industries. You go a long way in slide 7, so I'm kind of agreeing with Russ there where you got the start. But to take it a step further to say in your mind what's in and what's out and why they're in and why they're out, I think is really important. And as well, in plain English, saying here's the characteristics that define the rate regulator. So they have to have these characteristics to be a rate regulator. I think, again, and then other things like, you know, helping people understand, you know, look at your circumstances. When you have the rate regulator, is there the basis for setting the rate? Is there the regulatory agreement? So don't take some of those basic things for granted. Include them in your communications.
Sven?
Yeah, I would also recommend going to the ED stage. I think from a new DP, I'm not expecting anything really new. I mean, all the issues are more or less on the table. We know that certain people still have concerns with the asset liability definition and all those things, so I'm not sure if there's any new message coming from another DP stage. However, I think your question here was going to another direction, right? It was more about are there any additional materials we could, regardless of how the due process will be, what can we do? Well, I'm a big fan of debits and credits, so I would love to see some examples with numbers and illustrative examples really showing, okay, what's the impact, what's the idea, in particular in interaction with other standards. So it was already IFRIC 12 mentioned, IFRS 15, of course. I mean, you call it a supplementary approach, so there is some sort of interaction. I think in an earlier meeting, we also came across this presentation issue, so where do we show this adjusted revenue? If it's a positive adjustment, probably everyone would agree to show it separately. But if it's negative, probably not. So that's so all these are, I think, also important things to know. And probably these are things where you can, well, motivate stakeholders to give you some sort of response if they really have an illustrative example saying that is how the bookkeeping mechanics work for this example, and in particular the interaction with other standards as well. Yeah, so that's my...
Thank you.
Mary?
I've just been thinking through a couple of comments, especially ones that came out of the first section, and the risk of getting stumped later by the staff on the project wanted to offer two personal observations, kind of on the theme of feedback, which is, Patricia, first, you had mentioned that we haven't focused to date on why we reached the conclusion about asset liability under the new conceptual framework and how the analysis might differ. I think strategically my advice, you know, my view at the board would be let's focus forward rather than back, because I can see creating a lot of turmoil about questions about current practice, et cetera, if we start going back and analyzing a document that we've said we're not going to use. I think there is a lot of intellectual curiosity, and there have been a lot of practice issues around that, but I wanted to flag up that at least if I were asked, having heard this discussion, that's one thing I think I'd have a lot of hesitation in terms of a piece of advice.
May I suggest, we weren't asking you to do it. We were saying a lot of people will ask you to do it.
Okay. Okay. I hadn't heard that.
But I also think we need to avoid the impression that we needed the new conceptual framework to reach the conclusion.
We're just looking at it only under the new conceptual framework. Yeah. And the other is, it goes to the similarities and differences from U.S. GAAP. Now, I think one of the things the staff had planned was to bring first to the board and, you know, kind of presume that there would be some kind of analysis we might provide about similarities and differences. And while I think from my pretty sketchy understanding of U.S. GAAP, it's rusty, especially about this subject, I think that there are many instances in which the outcomes would be similar. One of the things that we have heard, including from members of our consultative group, and I agree with them, is that the thought process in this differs in a number of ways from U.S. GAAP. So I didn't want to leave kind of on the table the impression that there are going to be just a few minor differences at the fringes. I think very often the outcomes will be similar, but the thought process you use to get there will be different. And I just I think we're going to have to walk a fine line between saying that so that people really pick up the document and read it as the document rather than reading it through the lens of knowing U.S. GAAP, but also not overplay it, because I think in many instances, especially when the entitlement that you earn is one to just recover costs, that's when I would particularly expect the outcomes to be aligned. So I just was kind of putting up a cautionary flag about that point. So I seem to have escaped the thumping, at least.
You just pinched a bit of my summary.
Okay.
Just one other unrelated comment. I expect that in either May or June, the Canadian board will be debating when to issue our research paper. So we're certainly keeping in touch with the staff about your pace of project, et cetera. But we're at the stage now where we risk the paper becoming out of date if we don't issue it, you know, on a timely basis, or we need to do more work. And so we're going to be making that decision. So my offer is still on the table. If anybody has any last things they want to contribute to the research paper, what we do need to know, because we're probably going to be making the decision very shortly.
Okay, Jane, if you could give a summing up of what you have heard.
Indeed.
You heard a lot, but
I did hear a lot, and I'll try and keep the summary quite short. I think in terms of the direction of the project, I heard a lot of very encouraging thoughts that the analysis that we're carrying out, looking at the framework and trying to make sure that we combine the conceptual arguments as well as keeping an eye on the operational activities, because obviously the closer those two things marry together, the better the outcome, I think, in that we can justify the model and it can actually be applied in practice as close to the conceptual arguments that we're putting forward. The unit of account, I heard a general, I think, acceptance that we've got the right unit of account. It is something that, in practice, this is what people are tracking. I heard that we need to make sure that we're clear that these are identifiable timing differences, not necessarily just individual ones. There needs to be clear evidence that this is a timing difference and not just some generic earnings management was the phrase I heard. Earnings management just moving between estimates and actuals. That focuses also on the enforceability of the regulatory agreement. I also heard that as far as the asset and liability definitions are concerned, we are much closer to a clearer understanding of why we think these things are assets and liabilities, but there's still some work to do on making sure that we walk through the rationale and we walk through the individual steps, and we've got some good ideas to make sure that we communicate that through the project as we're going along. I also heard that the definition of the liability is much trickier than the definition of the asset. particularly with the onerous contract idea, where if we're adjusting our price to charge a lower rate in the future, we could still be making a profit. But from our point of view, that's not really the point. It is that we have received some benefit already for activities that we haven't yet completed, or we've incurred a penalty. The mechanism that we're going to use for paying that penalty is a reduction of the price, but that reduction of the price, as with any increase of the price that we're talking about here, is for a limited period, because it's focused on trying to make an adjustment to the overall amount that we are charging to customers. So it is a timing difference. It's not a permanent change to the price that's going to cover future activities, future input cost changes, etc. It's very much focused on that timing difference. As far as the scope is concerned, I think I heard general, again, encouragement that we're on the right lines. We heard some concerns continue about the possibility of analogizing to other situations. So as far as communication of the scope, we need to make sure that we're very clear what we mean by enforceable, what we mean by the rate regulator, particularly in related party situations, and how the related party ties in to how much discretion is permitted by the regulatory framework and that binding agreement itself. As far as communications are concerned, we have a little bit of a mixture between discussion paper and exposure draft as the next consultative document, with a slight lean towards exposure draft. That's something that we intend to ask the board once we've got through discussions about measurement, because we feel that that's obviously a very major part of the model. We feel that we've made good progress on scope, asset and liability definition. One other very quick update: we also spoke with the board at the last March meeting about recognition. And here again, we're talking about recognising those identifiable timing differences, not recognition in the context of the regulatory agreement as a whole. So we have started to cover some of these issues about the recoverability, particularly of the assets, and the impact of demand risk. But we are going to cover more of that as we go through the measurement issues going along. And communications, I think we also heard that perhaps just an exposure draft or a DP is not going to be enough. We need to make sure, as we're writing whatever the next consultation document is, we do carry on doing our outreach. We have done quite a lot, and we're using our consultative group to try and field test, if you like, some of these decisions and the descriptions as we go along. But we will try and make sure that we do more of that before we issue the next consultation document too. As Mary said, we're not looking backwards. We're looking forwards only at the revised conceptual framework. And we appreciate that in terms of communication, we'll need to communicate what it says in that revised conceptual framework, not just focusing on rate-regulated activities. So we will work with the conceptual framework team to make sure that those are running together. And the US GAAP comparison, yes, that's what
I would also encourage you that when you say we refer to the conceptual framework, to not say we are referring to the new conceptual framework.
Yes, it's the one and only existing.
The one and only,
To
avoid the impression that we needed the new conceptual framework to be able to come to these conclusions, because I think we could have done it under the old conceptual framework also.
I think the difficulty there is there was so much to-ing and fro-ing with the old conceptual framework. Some people could reach these conclusions, some people couldn't reach these conclusions. So rather than reopen all of those old debates, much better to just focus on what we have and work forwards from that. And again, sorry, yeah, just the US GAAP comparison, we do have that on our to-do list, that once we've got the model further developed in a little bit more detail, particularly with measurement, we will try and do that comparison. But as Mary suggested, our feelings at the moment, our understanding is many of the outcomes will be very similar. There will be some differences in detail, but the rationale that we're having to reach those outcomes is very different.
12? IFRIC 12?
Oh, sorry, and IFRIC 12 is also on our to-do list. The general comparison, the interactions with other standards are needed because of this supplementary approach, but IFRIC 12 in particular is a big area that we'll come back to again. Once we've got the model more developed, we can see more easily then exactly how the two interact. Thanks for the reminder, Mary. With that, thank you all very much indeed, unless there are any final comments.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Okay.